Welcome to the podcast. I am Chris Graham. We're going to talk politics today, and we are pleased that we have Sam Rasool, a Roanoke state delegate, joining us on the show. And Sam is running for the Democratic Party nomination for lieutenant governor. And we're also pleased to say that Augusta Free Press is backing, endorsing Sam in that run for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor. So, Sam, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to be with you, Chris, and great to be with familiar friends, Chris and Crystal, going way back to my congressional run. And I appreciate all the wonderful work that you all have been doing for so many years.
That's right. 2008 is when we first got to know Sam, when a then very young Sam, because you still, Sam, it doesn't look like you've aged in 13 years. And that's amazing to say that you were running for the 6th District seat in Congress against then incumbent Bob Goodlatte. And what jumped out to us then and still stands with us to this day is just how hard you work then. We see it in what you do in the House of Delegates now and in the years you've been there. But you were everywhere in 2008, up and down 81, visiting every small group of Democrats and independents and others you could meet with. And that hard work is what drew us to want to support you in this race.
Well, I appreciate that. It's something that's important to me. You know, I remember growing up and hearing about the presidential candidates who would go to Iowa and visit every one of the 99 counties in Iowa. And so I said, man, I'm running for lieutenant governor. I want to visit every one of the 133 cities and counties in Virginia and gather the stories of the struggles of everyday Virginians and uplift those stories. So that way we're a better connected Commonwealth. And I've been from tip to tip, Accomack County on the Eastern Shore to Lee County. And there's about 10 hours in between them. So it's a big Commonwealth for sure.
Yeah, my wife was the state director for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention for a couple of years. And she had to drive around not quite as much as you, but maybe close to as much as you. And I would tag along with her on some of those ventures. And you learn how big Virginia is when you have to go on the roads, especially Southwest Virginia, all the way to the Eastern Shore, like you said, Northern Virginia. This is a big state, and to undertake the venture you have, especially in this unique year, says a lot about commitment on your part.
It does, for sure. And I know, Crystal, your wife is moved by her personal family story, by the work that she has done. And same here, just growing up in a working class family, wanting to make sure that people's stories and their struggles are uplifted. And so when we're very fortunate to be able to do something that we love and put our heart and soul into it.
So today, rolling out some news, let's go into a release from your campaign today and another strategy plan from you and a couple of important points. You know, healthcare access, healthcare lowering costs, part of your plan, a Marshall Plan for moms, tax rebates for small businesses, a support for a public option. Talk about those strategies and how they can improve life in the Commonwealth.
Yeah, you know, so we've done some great things actually over the past couple few years as far as improving access, expanding Medicaid, but having a true public option so that way everyone can buy into some of the state-run plans that we have. To me, it is critical to make sure that access is there for sure as we move forward. In addition to that, making sure that we've got access to healthcare providers, expanding the scope where necessary. When we're talking about rural health equity, we need to do things like what we just passed this past year, which was my budget amendment to bring a nursing program to rural Virginia. Beyond that, for our full kind of COVID recovery, we see that women have been disproportionately impacted as far as the economics are concerned during this downturn. And it's not just the money, it's really, there's a lot of trauma there with lives being turned over. And so at the state level, what we need to be doing is at least stepping up and helping out, providing comprehensive childcare, paid medical and family leave, paid sick leave, even child, what we call caregiver tax credits. So because many of Virginians, including myself, for example, we've got youngins and then we've got, you know, our parents that we're taking care of. And those caregivers need to be valued somehow here in the Commonwealth. And we also, of course, have businesses that are struggling. And we've seen so many shutter during this difficult time. And so by making those additional investments in Rebuild Virginia, by having some tax rebates specifically for Main Street businesses, I think are some ways that Virginia can step up.
Yeah, Governor Northam talking today about the vaccine access and setting April 18th as a date when Virginia, all Virginians 16 and over will be eligible to and able to receive vaccines. He also talked about the light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully that light gets a little closer every day. But I saw some distressing news and just reported on it. We're recording this podcast at 1 o'clock on a Thursday, just about a half hour ago. The latest numbers, every Thursday, the Virginia Employment Commission puts out new numbers on the new initial unemployment claims. And we saw a sharp increase this week. So even though the light's at the end of the tunnel and a lot of businesses, you know, a lot of them have been affected, but a lot have done well through this as well. You know, when we see those numbers, those are, it was an increase this week just of 10,000 additional Virginians filing initial unemployment claims. I think the number was 28,000. I mean, it was still, there's some work to do here to get us through this.
Yeah, there definitely is. And especially our smallest businesses, those, you know, mom and pop Main Street businesses that are struggling to make ends meet. Look, the reality is for some of the larger businesses, they've been able to take better advantage of the Paycheck Protection Program and some of the other incentives there. But we certainly have more work to do. And we all know that it takes some time for in any economic downturn, it takes some time for our workers to really catch up because many of them are the first ones hit.
So I want to switch gears for a few minutes and talk about why run for lieutenant governor. Of course, you've been in the House of Delegates for several years now. Was it 2014, Sam?
Yep, this is my eighth year now.
Eighth year now. So, and you've had successes. You've been able to work with in the majority for the last couple of years now. I'm sure that's refreshing after sitting on the other side of the aisle and maybe having to work even harder to get your voice heard in the House of Delegates. So why run for lieutenant governor now? What made you decide to throw your hat in 2021?
Yeah, it wasn't an easy decision. I've certainly enjoyed my 8 years in the General Assembly, and especially over the past year and a half being in the majority. We've been able to get a lot of great work done for sure. The trade-off for me was taking these issues that I care very deeply about and having a new and higher platform with which to discuss many of them, casting those critically important tie-breaking votes in the Senate, working with the incoming governor, whoever she or he may be, to try to bring a different perspective, whether it be in education, with some of my education work, my healthcare work, or environment, or having a regional perspective that might be unique to the administration. But lastly, wanting to do more of the work, Chris, that I really love, which is building these broad coalitions and doing some of this shifting in politics. You know, today we just see, the complete alienation and tearing of each other down, which is not the way we should be approaching things. And so for me, whether you had mentioned, what we're calling Virginia Grit, visiting every city and county in person, to the Impact Center, which we started, which has trained over 2,000 candidates and activists, to the Democratic Promise, which says, why don't we, as part of the way we campaign and connect, actually help people with the government services that they need? There are some great ways to reform the way we approach politics, especially on the Democratic side, that I think can be helpful. And I hope to be able to do more of that as your next lieutenant governor.
So lieutenant governor in Virginia is an interesting position. It's a part-time position of formally. You have the defined role of casting those tie-breaking votes when necessary. There are a couple of commissions, I think, that the state code appoints you to. But other than that, it's open-ended, and it really is up to the person as to how to define that job. And we've seen some really good lieutenant governors who've really used that job well in the past. I thought Tim Kaine was a great lieutenant governor back in the early 2000s. And Bill Bowling, actually, I thought two terms on the other side of the aisle, Republican. I thought he did a really good job using that role. How would you define it? You're elected in November. You take office in January. How do you use that office to benefit Virginia?
Yeah, I first always have this one philosophy. Am I standing on the right side of history? I mean, I think Virginians appreciate someone, regardless of the current politics of the time, that is trying to make the decision that is on the right side of history, that is in the best interest of the Commonwealth. And during my time in the legislature over the past 8 years, I try to be a good team player in lots of different ways, but it always comes back to the decision that I make, the votes that I cast, they need to be in the best interest of the people. And so if just so happens that party politics is going one way and the interest of the people is going another, now I'm not afraid to stand up and say, this is what's right for Virginians. And it's important. And as your next lieutenant governor, I won't be afraid to do that. And I think that Virginians will welcome that.
Now let's go back to some issues. Yesterday, the governor released his proposal to speed up the reform of marijuana possession laws from 2024 to July 1st of 2021, basically legalizing the simple possession, not just decriminalizing like the General Assembly did last year, but actually legalizing the simple possession of marijuana. What is your sense on that? What are your initial thoughts on that? And how do you see that working out? Do you think the General Assembly will go along?
Yeah, I think the General Assembly will pass. The reality is that the amendments, of course, are voted on and adopted independently. And so it may be that not all of it passes the House and Senate, but we'll see what happens. I will say, however, this was a very big bill, lots of different components. I wish it wasn't one bill. I wish it was broken up. I think some of the criminal justice reform pieces needed to be bold and be included. The bill that passed the House did not have all of those reforms in there that passed the General Assembly at the end, because the Senate had pulled some of it out. And so for me, there's a few things that we look at. Comprehensive criminal justice reform has to be part of the equation. Number two, any revenues that are produced, I think a higher percentage than what the governor has proposed needs to go back into these communities that have been disproportionately impacted over the years. And I hope that we can do more to reform it for sure. And that however we approach the commercialization question needs to be done in a very equitable way. We should not allow powerful special interests to take over any of these issues where it's just serving the wealth of a few.
Yeah. We did a podcast last week talking with some folks who were leading an effort to oppose the proposed expansion of the Middle River Regional Jail, a regional jail serving the Augusta County greater area, the Rockingham County greater area, some areas north of us as well. And one of the issues that came up there was that through a FOIA request, this group discovered that I think it was 75% of the inmates currently there are actually people either there for drug crimes or other nonviolent crimes. And I'm presuming, without having seen a breakdown from that even further, that a lot of these folks would be people who could be impacted by simple marijuana possession on their record that maybe then impacts them down the road. There's a lot of people in our jails and prisons that could benefit from not just the legalization, but then the expunging of records in the past. And then more, less people in jail, less people in prison, more people hopefully getting substance abuse education, more people being able to be productive in the community. These are all good things, I would think, as we go down the road.
Yeah, they are. And this is one where I like to say and point out, when the Koch brothers and President Obama and others agree, we clearly have spent so much on this prison industrial complex that we have as a society. So we are wasting a lot of tax dollars by, keeping folks locked up, and especially because we criminalized mental health instead of trying to really approach it with a very solutions-oriented model. And so as we proceed, I hope that we'll be able to reform the way we think through some of this and bring people together, because I know that there are people on both sides of the aisle who think that there's a better way to use some of these tax dollars.
Yeah. And I love what you said there about the mental health part too. That's something that's near and dear to our hearts with my wife's work in suicide prevention. And it does seem like we can do a better job. We still have it where it seems like when people have mental health crises, that you call 911, police come, and You know, it's one thing to say we're going to start training police, and some police departments have been progressive about this, training their officers in how to deal with mental health situations. We still see the horror stories of situations that get out of control and end up with tragedies because of maybe the lack of training, the lack of understanding, and situations that didn't need to be handled that way. Maybe we can use more social services workers to deal with those kind of situations. And if we could just earmark the resources to go there, we could do that. But obviously it's so complicated and such a tough thing to get started, but we have to start working in that direction.
Yeah, that is for sure. And I think instead of dealing with it, owning it, especially as one of the richest states in the nation, we just need to get our priorities straight there for sure.
So let's talk voting rights reform. This also news this week from the governor with the signing of the Voting Rights Act. I know this is something you're very passionate about. And certainly we're seeing some states move in the other direction since the Supreme Court decision from a few years ago that made it so states didn't have to get that federal approval under the Voting Rights Act at the federal level. We've seen a number of Republican states move to make it harder to vote, but Virginia is on the right side of history, to use your term from a few minutes ago. We're making it easier to vote and trying to encourage that. Just want to get your thoughts on the governor's actions this week, the General Assembly's actions from earlier this year in voting rights.
Yeah, well, we've come such a long way. I've been on the Elections Committee all 8 years that I've been in the General Assembly, and have seen this consistent attack on our ability to vote. And then fortunately, over the past couple of years, we've made some significant progress. We went from 49th in the nation to now 12th as far as ease of access to vote. And the reality is they have not been shy about their attack on voting rights. And for me, you just go back to some of the leaders of the modern conservative movement. Look back there on YouTube. In 1980, one of the founders said at the Republican convention, national convention, "We don't want everyone to vote. You know, the more people that vote, the worse we do." And I think that was really a lot of foreshadowing for many policies that now have really alienated so many people. But we've made a lot of progress here in Virginia. One game changer has been bringing on early voting. And so, you know, we think that there'll be some record turnout for the primary that starts April 24th and moving forward. But we have a little bit of work still left to do.
Yeah, the fact that the primary, I'm glad you said it that way. The primary starts April 24th. We're thinking about a June primary, but it starts April 24th. That's one of the reasons we wanted to endorse early in the race, because typically when people make endorsements and organizations make endorsements, they wait until like a week before the election day. A lot of people, I mean, if habits have been formed already from this past November, a lot of people will be getting out early to vote just because, I mean, maybe this past fall, it was more the fear of certainly, you know, the unknown of COVID. Maybe now that we see the light at the end of the tunnel, now it's just, hey, I can vote whenever I want to. If I know I can vote and I know who I'm voting for, let's go do it. It's easier that way. And so let's hope that the genie doesn't get put back in the bottle. Let's keep it the way it is, right? And move even further down the road.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what needs to happen. We need to be bold about our stance here. And make sure that people have access to the voting booth. And look, this is deep in our history where we've gone back and forth on this. The dark history before 1865, and then you had the readjuster movement, which brought in more rights, and then Jim Crow took away more rights, and then we had to wait for the civil rights era, and then the new, you know, kind of war on drugs and war on crime and finding different ways of taking people's ability to vote. Look, people should just have the access to be able to participate in our democracy. And we should push back with everything that we have against the attacks and threats there.
I like to frame things in terms of, okay, the last year has impacted our lives. A lot, obviously a lot of folks have lost their lives, and we put our hearts out to them and their families. But there are a lot of things that we've done in the last year that hopefully we can continue to do. I mean, among the things, I love seeing people in person. And Sam, I hope we get to, you know, see you again in person here pretty soon. But the Zooms have been great. You know, I mean, at least we keep up with people this way. There are some good and some bad. I think that I'd like to get your thoughts on some of the things that we need to, as we're starting to think about the light at the end of the tunnel from COVID-19, among the things that need attention, it seems to me certainly education. Our kids in the last year have had haphazard, in a lot of cases, haphazard education at best. You know, we've certainly some folks adapted well to the Zoom classes and others did not. What can we do as we see a light at the end of the tunnel to maybe make up for what could be, for a lot of kids, a lost year of education, which of course could set them back many times over as they get older?
Yeah, you know, our schools, many of them were struggling to begin with for lots of different reasons. And one project that I've been doing is to substitute teach in every school in my city here until COVID hit. And I just saw firsthand how difficult it is, and then lay COVID on top of that. Look, number one, we have no excuse for not paying our teachers at least the national average, and we're so far below that. So as a Commonwealth, we have to invest in our teachers so that way we can have the workforce to be able to get it done. And right now there's just so much turnover, so much stress. Number two, getting our help to these localities and local school districts that are really struggling. You know, right now we're making them make some difficult decisions in some spots. And now is the time for us to invest. You know, Virginia has a budget surplus, Chris, and we have not touched our reserves. And it seems like now would be the time to make sure that our localities are invested in, especially our schools. Number three, coming up with, you know, what does our school construction and reconstruction look like? We have schools that are crumbling in every corner. You know, whether I've been on the Eastern Shore or down in Southwest Virginia, we hear this inequity in our school infrastructure, in the resources that are put in. When you have all these schools who can barely offer some of the basics, like certain language programs, certain math programs, CTE, you know, equity means that everyone has access to be able to succeed. And so in the short term, there are some things that we definitely need to be focusing on.
Yeah, I'm the product of a school system. Augusta County schools 30 years ago weren't funded nearly as well, and they probably still aren't as some of the schools in Northern Virginia. And that's it's an equity issue. Certainly, I'm curious. You would substitute teach in a different school in your district. I also have an experience as a substitute teacher from way back when I was first getting into journalism. I was only a part time guy, so I supplemented that income with substitute teaching experiences. Talk about that. Maybe how did the kids treat you like kids in my era used to treat substitute teachers, which was not very well. Hopefully, you had better experiences than that.
I can tell you that number one, they don't care that you're a delegate. You're still going to get the level of respect that a substitute teacher is going to get. Number two, I probably wasn't as good to my substitute teachers as I should have been. So karma is coming right back around. And then lastly, the struggles are real. And I got to see the mental health challenges, the lack of support, the struggles with regards to the school infrastructure. And I feel like some of these teachers, they come to school every day and it's almost like going through a little war zone. I mean, to have to deal with so much of that. And in the middle of it, try to get some information transmitted to the students. So, you know, God bless our teachers who are working hard for us.
Yes, indeed. And I will second you on that. I did not treat my substitute teachers well. I got the karma back and also learned a lot and how I wanted to be a teacher. And I realized that it's a challenge. And I know some people might like to think that it's an easy thing to do. It's not easy to teach kids. And what a great idea. I mean, I don't know, you know, how you came up with that idea, but what a way to learn. It's one thing to visit a school. I mean, you know, as a politician, as a state delegate, when you're invited to do something and taken on a tour of something, you're shown the best of things. When you spend a day in a classroom, you're seeing the best, the worst, and everything in between. And what a way to learn how things work.
Yeah. It's eye-opening. That's for sure. So we learn a lot.
What other kind of experiences like that maybe have you taken? I know as a journalist, I get to do similar kind of things from time to time. I've toured jails and prisons and heard the door lock behind me. And that definitely was something that stood out with me, among things like that. What other kind of experiences have you taken on that have given you similar kind of insight?
Yeah, even this past fall, I went on a ride along with a lieutenant here in Roanoke City. Went on a late night Friday night shift with the Roanoke City Police Department and the lieutenant, and to trade some ideas, but also to see firsthand what they're dealing with day to day. And so we did half of the night shift there, and we were pulling out at 9 p.m. and immediately were summoned to a stabbing that was happening. And so we go to an immediate, crime scene, and it's kind of so frantic. And then, a series of stops and things that have happened throughout the evening. But in between all of it, we had a pretty deep conversation. If you might recall, there was one shooting in Atlanta back then in a Wendy's parking lot of an individual by an officer. That was a pretty heated time. I was able to see, my whole point is to see some of that perspective, to hear. And I've always tried to, during my time in the General Assembly, whether it be in education or public safety, in touring a lot of these local businesses, just try to understand where people are coming from as best I can, because quite frankly, a lot of these decisions are not black and white.
You mentioned business, and I want to go into that too. You have a background in small business and have for quite a long time. One thing that's important to me as I'm making decisions on who to support is, you're voting on budgets and you're voting on things that, that deal with money, but also a lot of things that impact people who are in business. And I value the experience that people who are running for office have, making payroll, dealing with the ups and downs of the business cycle, recessions and coming back from them, that kind of thing. How has your business experience helped you as a delegate and a candidate for lieutenant governor?
Just understanding the basics of how a budget works and being able to appreciate cash flow. You've got revenues and expenses and where are you going to get the funds from? Certainly gives you a different perspective. And so you really want to think through, but also just the different struggles that Main Street businesses, as somebody who's owned and operated several of them, I feel like there's Main Street, then there's like the larger small businesses that maybe have 200 employees and then they get bigger from there. Having started up, a little, my first business was a little video store. Remember these little Blockbusters?
Yeah.
It was like a little video store out in the country. This is going back almost 20 years. And so when you actually have to go through the churn and all of the above, it's not easy. So we want to really empathize with the folks who are struggling. And I feel like my business background has helped me decipher who's really struggling versus where we should be putting some of our resources, and empathizing with those who need us the most.
So kind of a personal question, you come from a working class background. I do too. And so I'm asking this question from experience, I guess. Because I've been asked this question myself, where does your ambition come from? I mean, you started a small business 20 years ago, a small video store out in the middle of nowhere. And you've been doing what you've been doing since, with other small businesses, running for office. I mean, where does this come from within? Is this something that you've always had? I mean, for me as a kid, I knew I wanted to do more. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I wanted to do more. Has it been something with you ever since you can remember?
When I was at the age of 5, I remember standing on a milk crate, ringing the register as customers were coming through my parents' corner store. Uh-huh. And looking back, it's probably where I learned, quote unquote, politics, because politics is really just a people business, right? And so rich, poor, black, white, brown, everyone that came in, you learned to relate to them. And I remember just loving to go to work with my parents, and really thinking through, you know, even as soon as I could get a job, I was working two jobs through high school and college, you know, finishing high school a year early, finishing college a year early. I was just always in a hurry to just get things done. And I wasn't, you know, the top of my class in high school or anything like that. But I know I wanted to get things done while I could. And then all of a sudden one day I, you know, started running for office. It wasn't that I had thought, oh, I'm always going to run for office. But, you know, I've been very fortunate. I think a product of a good upbringing and coming from working class roots. Both of us, Chris, there's always that little fire, right? It's always like, I gotta make sure that I'm on my toes because, you know, something can go south pretty quickly. And that fire to some respect, you know, has helped me, because I've always felt like I needed to keep pushing on.
Yeah. Never rest. Cause today's an important day and tomorrow is too. That's right. And so how do you impart that to your kids now? You know, it was passed down to you. How do you impart that down within your own situation?
Yeah, lots of different ways, but I boil it down to our three family values. Always tell the truth, always be kind, and never give up. And that truth, love, and grit is how we built this whole campaign. You've heard me talk about, you know, loving our neighbors through Democratic Promise, crowdsourcing ideas by uplifting the truth, and then Virginia grit. So it's making sure that it is really a consistent part of fathering and of parenting with my wife and I. So we always just try to make sure, hey, if you're starting something, you better finish it. And, you know, don't ask me to start something if you're not going to finish it. And my kids know that, you know, and hopefully, they'll have, and I can see that many, that they have that drive, as well.
You talked about Democratic Promise. Let's talk about that. It's an important thing. And I love the premise, it seems like so much in politics, we can just talk about the quote unquote issues and let's talk about policy positions and things like that. But we can't overlook the fact that government needs to serve people. And that's one of the main tenets for you for Democratic Promise. Talk about that effort. And this predates certainly your lieutenant governor campaign and something you've been doing for a while.
Yeah, voting is not a logical decision based on issues. It is an emotional decision. And we can either appeal to the emotion of fear, which we see most of the time in politics, or the emotion of trust, where we're building quality relationships with people. And so to me, it makes great sense that especially being a Democrat, a person who believes that these institutions play an important role in our lives, that in our campaigning, in our connecting, we should be helping people along the way. You know, I meet many people in my district who maybe don't know all of the policies and the votes that I take, but they remember if I was there for them, if when they called, I picked up the phone, when they needed help, we were doing our best to advocate for them. And so this is critically important. And I think that's the way we build goodwill and trust in politics and institutions and even at the party level.
Yeah. One thing that gets my attention, I living in the Waynesboro, Augusta County area, I am a minority politically, so to speak, as a Democrat in a very Republican area. And I think that Democrats do need to think, big D Democrats need to think more about reaching out to folks, not just pigeonholing, hey, that's a Republican voter. They got a Republican sign in their yard. Let's not think about those folks. It's easy to do that in this polarized era that we live in, but I don't think we get anywhere by dividing into those camps. And so, like you said there, you know, most people don't think the way Fox News or CNN tells us how to think. Most people are just people who are working hard. They want to provide for their families. They want to provide for themselves. They want to provide a good life. If the simple act of reaching out to them the way you can through your Democratic Promise can help out, but Yeah, I think that we've allowed ourselves to become too divided. And I think we need to find ways to reach out and realize that we're at the end, we're all Americans.
Yeah, that humanity is a common appeal. And people are struggling in lots of different ways. When you scratch your head and you try to think, well, how did November 2016 actually happen to begin with? Let's kind of come back to, you know, making sure that we never go back to that deep, dark place. And for a lot of people, while we had some, you know, good news over the past several months, politically and otherwise, we still need to be doing a lot of work to rebuilding.
So let's wrap up, Sam. I've taken a lot of your time, and I thank you so much for everything you've talked about. I like to give the opportunity to a candidate. I'm inspired by Mark Warner, who once said this when I was covering him, either when he was running for governor or senator the first time. I don't remember which one it was. But he said, essentially, I feel like I'm applying for a job, and so I'm asking you to give me a job. So in the context of, Sam, you're asking for people to approve you for a job, why should people vote for Sam Rasul?
You know, I believe in a better way to win, a different type of politics fundamentally that challenges the way we engage and the way we approach each other. From my first run, as you remember, Chris, when I ran for Congress back in 2007, 2008, I believed in this grassroots style politics that really used new age relational organizing to build these relationships and not think about, well, who's red and who's blue, who's Democrat and who's Republican, but really to think about what can we be doing to bring people together, to fight for the common good. And so in the General Assembly over the past 8 years, I've tried to do that. I'm a member of the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus, as well as the Virginia Legislative Rural Caucus. And together we, you know, push for equity, whether it be in the education funding that you were talking about or the criminal justice reform. To me, this is the future of politics if we want to make some real progress. So let's keep building on these coalitions that we've built. And to me, you know, we don't want to sit as just innocent bystanders. I want to be your next lieutenant governor so I can play an active role in moving the needle about the way we connect and the way we are as neighbors to one another.
That's why we're backing Sam Rasul. Thank you, Sam, for that well-stated position there. And so thank you for everything. And good luck on the campaign trail. It's the voting starts April 24th. We go into June with the primary. A lot of hard work still to do on your part. Best of luck to you on those travels.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris. And my best to Crystal as well.